Welcome to Alumni Live, the podcast. These are conversations with Grand Valley State University film and video graduates about the industry, the film video major, and alumni profiles.
Welcome back to Alumni Live, the podcast. My name is Malcolm Cramp, a senior in Grand Valley's film and video program. Today, we will be discussing the experience and challenges of working in film production for autistic people as both film students and professionals in the industry. Joining me today is Ryan Copping, GVSU film video alumni from the class of 2006. Ryan is a screenwriter, film and culture historian, and visiting professor teaching film study classes here at Grand Valley State University. Ryan, thank you for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
Before we begin, I would like to take this moment to clarify our intended use of terminology such as autism and autistic with consideration and respect, as we acknowledge this may be perceived as sensitive to some listeners. Let's discuss some of your background, your education, career as a filmmaker, researcher, and subsequent work as a professor here at Grand Valley.
Well, I think I always wanted to be a filmmaker. Before it was film, it was actually radio. I got interested in radio when I was a child, and then it kind of morphed into film. I suppose I'm kind of a frustrated filmmaker because that's what my goal has always been. I didn't really set out for a career in academia. It just happened. I did my undergrad in film and video and still photography here in 2002 to 2006. I then did my master's in communications. And while I was doing the master's, I was just offered to teach a class as an adjunct. And I wasn't really expecting it, but I took the opportunity and I enjoyed it. And it just built from there. After I graduated, I taught for 3 years. And then I went over to England and I did a PhD there. Then I came back here. And now I'm in my second year as a visitor at Grand Valley.
Lovely. Recently, on a previous episode of Alumni Live, we discussed the profile of Grand Valley alum Tim Daly at Exceptional Minds, a California-based academy that helps to prepare autistic students for a career in animation and post-production. From that, you reached out to us with the idea for a deeper dive to discuss autistic individuals working in the film industry and as film students.
Well, I got the idea for this because of my experiences both as an autistic person, as a student in the program, on the film shoots that I've worked on, and also as a professor. I feel that in many ways, although it's gotten a lot better in the last 20 years, autism is kind of invisible. It's not something that a lot of people necessarily think about. And I've had students who identified as autistic or diagnosed as autistic, and I'm not entirely certain that their needs and rights are being recognized as much as they should be. So that's why I'm here.
I feel like that's an important baseline to establish because, as you mentioned, historically, autism is often very misinformed or normally a misunderstood diagnosis, and one that has often not been represented with consideration in culture and media. To give a brief baseline for listeners, what is the autism spectrum and why is it considered a spectrum?
Yes, this is a big question. So autism is a neurological difference from people who are not autistic, who we generally call allistic. These people used to be called neurotypicals, but there's some problem with that, so I use the term allistic. Basically, it's generally believed that the way parts of the brain are connected to each other is different in autistic people. I'm not a neurologist, so I can't necessarily go into it more than this. The diagnosis of autism is one that is based on behavior, cognition, and experience. So unfortunately, there's no CAT scan or blood test or anything like that that you can take to determine whether someone is autistic. So we have these neurological differences that appear to be built around the way parts of the brain are connected to each other. It's very likely that autism is a normal part of the human experience. There have probably been autistic people throughout history through prehistoric times. The explosions of diagnoses that we've seen in the last 30 years or so are probably just it being recognized in people, not actually more cases. The way that these neurological differences manifest themselves is different in each person. And it's also very hard to actually say, is this because the person is autistic or is this because of something else? Because it's like saying, why do you like jazz music or something? It could be a neurological reason, it could be psychological, it could be your grandfather played jazz and you really like it. It's very hard to actually say that someone is doing one thing because they are autistic. That said, there are lots of traits that are typically associated with autistic people, although not all may have them. One that I struggle with is sensory issues. And this is one thing I feel very strongly about. most holistic people, not all, but most holistic people can go into a place that they've never been before. And they don't have to worry about, can I physically bear to be in this room? Whereas a lot of autistic people, and definitely me, every time I go anywhere new, there's always the question of, is it too loud? Is there going to be a smell that's going to make me nauseous? Can I eat the food there? If it's too hot or too cold, can I leave? I have trouble with certain fabrics. Like, you never see me wear a sweater or a jumper if you're in the UK, because I can't stand how it feels on my skin. Another thing that is somewhat sensitive to talk about, and I want to choose my words carefully here, is at least a perception that many autistic people struggle with social skills. I think that's a very reductive way of looking at this. However, I do feel that some autistic people, including myself, sometimes struggle with connecting or communicating with other people. The reason why I want to be careful what I say here is that it's very easy to fall into a kind of negative stereotype, which I've read on the internet. Autistic people are hopelessly uncool geeks who don't have any friends or things like that. And that's a stereotype, and that's problematic. And I do want to say there are some autistic people, just as there are some holistic people, who are kind of loners and solitary, but many of them choose to be like that, and that's just the way that they want to be. That said, I do think that many autistic people feel a sense of social ostracism and bigotry and prejudice against them, because the world is not really designed for them, and people are not necessarily designed for their needs or some of the behaviors that they want to demonstrate. So that's a problem, but that's really more one of social discrimination than it is of the person.
Would you mind sharing a few details of your personal journey?
In regards to the sensory stuff, that's probably the most obvious one. When I was a little kid, I went to my mother and I said, there's a worm in my shoe. And she couldn't understand what I was talking about. And what was going on was my sock was folded within my shoe. It didn't hurt exactly, but it was distracting and uncomfortable. I couldn't really focus on anything else. And I think it was difficult for teachers to understand why that was a problem. I remember in the third grade, I had poor balance and I would sometimes fall out of my chair. I think the teacher thought I was doing it for attention when I wasn't. I was literally just losing my balance. I already shared that there's always a kind of apprehension when I go to a new place because I don't know necessarily if I can handle it from a sensory standpoint. I do want to say about 95% of the time I try not to let it stop me from going to new places. But when you do hit that 5% of the time of like, geez, I can't concentrate on what this person's saying because the music's so loud or whatever, that gets bad really fast. So you carry that with you. In regards to some of the social things, I really didn't have very many friends as a child. I was called by the other children as being strange and unusual. And I think part of this is I admittedly had some interests that kids at the time didn't really have. Like we mentioned, radio. I read an encyclopedia on 1940s radio broadcasting when I was 9, cover to cover. In retrospect, in 1993, that probably was not what most of the other children were interested in. They were talking about Michael Jackson and things like that. I think some of it is just the conformity that I think a lot of children or younger teenagers feel, or at least they did in my generation. I'm a millennial. Kind of gets better. And then it got a lot better after I found out I was autistic when I was 29. One of the theories around this is that empathy kind of works like this, that you put yourself in a situation that you've never been in and you go, oh, I would feel like this in the situation, or I would want this. So that's what this person who's in the situation wants. I'm going to say this to them or do this for them. And the problem is that's not necessarily what the person wants. We often don't know what the other person wants. But autistic people have this problem in that if they put themselves in a certain situation, they can be so different from another person that this is a giant misjudgment. That's what autistic people are dealing with all the time. They're constantly trying to figure out, what should I say in this situation to make this person comfortable? I mean, that's what I would do now. Can I call someone? Are you okay? Do you want me to leave you alone? Can you get home all right? That's what I should have done, but I didn't think to do that.
I think it's very important to gain a little insight into that kind of perspective, because tying into our main subject with autistic individuals working on film productions, either as students or as professionals, this entire industry is based around new experiences, making experiences. Every film set is different. Every production is different. From your experience, what are the sort of challenges that create
Well, I think to begin with, it's generally believed that there are a lot of autistic people in media. Tony Atwood, I believe he said this, that the two industries that autistic people are most likely to work in are media and academia. So I think I might want to start by saying what the appeal of media to autistic people. And one is, in many ways, it's a way of slowing down the world. I think many autistic people perceive the world as rather chaotic and rather uncontrolled. And if you go specifically to see a movie, you're in a sense paying for a sensory cutoff experience, particularly in a theater. You're going in to a dark room where everything is designed to make you look and pay attention to what is going on in that room. That kind of ability to focus on a certain part of the world, and you can do this in literature and other mediums, is that's part of the appeal. I think many autistic people, or just speaking for myself, working in film production or media production is helpful because there's an etiquette that is easy to understand and explained usually to everyone. You know, if you're the first AC and you have a problem, you don't go and talk to the makeup person about that. I think that's part of the appeal. The biggest issue that I see everywhere, and probably if you've listened this far, you can guess what I'm going to say, is I wish that movie sets were more cognizant of sensory issues, particularly location shoots, particularly things having to do with loud noises. I think the safety is pretty good with this, but bright lights, that can be a problem. Particularly for me, going out on a location shoot, if I'm directing something, I've presumably been to that place before. Mm-hmm. But if you're just working on a movie, doing whatever, first AC or something, you get sent somewhere and you might be out in the desert and it's 95 degrees, you're suddenly in trouble. That can be a big problem. And I would say basically everywhere, more sensitivity to sensory issues.
I was going
to
add, because I have worked on some student film projects and Grand Valley Summer Film Project. I have worked above the line, below the line, in various positions. I've been production coordinator, unit production manager, AD in one case. And there's often the checklist of things to consider for a project, like schedule, food, budget, logistics, gear, and everything like that. But looking back on it, the thing that was always missing in that checklist, or the thing that was never brought up, was being considerate of the disposition of the needs of people on the crew. Okay, this person has a food allergy. Me, in my case, I am a severe asthmatic, so I always have to be aware of the environment I walk into. But as you touched on, we could do more steps to be more considerate and accommodating for people who have sensitivity issues on film sets. Do you have any further ideas?
Well, I also think that one thing that autistic people often struggle with are vague directions. And I think that's why this is a pretty good industry to work in, because put the camera over there. That's not an ambiguous statement. I suppose if you're directing an actor or something like that, there can be act more happy or something. That can be a little ambiguous. But it's also good because it's not necessarily difficult to understand. Another thing I think that all movie sets could do is how most of the time, and they should be doing this, the production coordinator or somebody calls everyone and says, do you have any dietary needs? Yes, I'm a diabetic. So that's very helpful. But I would like to see, for every movie or TV show or music video that's ever made, on the very first day of shooting, there's a company meeting where the UPM or somebody like that comes out and says, this is a high-stress industry. We're going to be having crisis situations here, but everyone here deserves to be treated respectfully. Mm-hmm. And we want anyone here who feels like that they're not being listened to or they're not being treated respectfully to go to this person who we've designated as the person that they can listen to or for this purpose and say what's going on. One of the disadvantages of the hierarchical structure of a film set is very often someone close to the bottom of the hierarchy has some kind of systemic problem. They can't go to the director or the producer and say, hey, this is happening. Every single shoot, particularly at least with the crew, who are probably going to be there most days, you have that message said, and there's a designated person who someone can talk to and try to mediate these issues so people don't feel like they need to suffer in silence or there's going to be retribution if they say something.
We're taking a short break to tell you about the Dirk Koenig Memorial Film and Video Scholarship. Here's Gretchen Vinich remembering Dirk Koenig.
The Koenig Scholarship enables students to get that kind of an education, to be a good filmmaker, to be able to express their voice, and to continue Dirk's dream.
For more information and to donate to the scholarship, visit the link in the description. Now back to the show.
So to switch gears a little bit, I would like to steer the conversation to your work here as a film professor at Grand Valley, because as you discussed the nature of this industry and the requirements and its characteristics, what sort of insights could you tell us about working with film students? What kind of challenges have you seen come about?
If I was teaching production or I was a producer, I think that the biggest thing is just awareness that there may be autistic people present. Part of this is you can't really look at someone and go, they're autistic. And often when I've disclosed this to somebody, I'm greeted with a, whoa, I had no idea. So being aware that there are autistic people around is important. There's a lot, I think, at the university or at any university that can be done. One is the STEM room. It could just be a quiet room or a private room or something like that. A room that an autistic person or really anyone, it could just be someone with, you know, anxiety issues or someone having a bad day or something, that they can go in and it's quiet. There might be some STEM toys or things like that there, and that they can just be by themselves and collect themselves and not feel the pressure to perform. Mm-hmm. One of the issues that I would say as a professor that I sometimes struggle with is you have to be there at a certain time. So it's sort of like if you have a 9-to-5 office job, you have to be there at 9 a.m, but depending on what you're doing, take a coffee break or calm down at your desk or something like that. But if I'm teaching a 3:00 to 4:15 class, I have to be there from 3:00 to 4:15, and sometimes you walk in there and something's going on and you just have to get through it. That is, of course, true of everybody. But I think in terms of students, it would be really good if we had the idea of attendance is required, but if you need to step out due to sensory issues or just any issues or something going on in your personal life and you don't want to be around other people, you need to take care of it, that's okay. And here's a designated place that you can go. And there really is no designated place so far as I know. There's certainly not one in LSH. I think there's a student lounge, but it doesn't really serve that purpose. So I would really be in favor of that, just a sensory room that students or faculty or staff or anyone could go. I want to emphasize to all of my autistic students or indeed students who are having any kind of issue that if you need to step out, it's okay. Now you need to talk to me about what you missed later. You would be expected to do that, but it's perfectly okay. It's something that could identify to a student to personally, but I've had students with other issues who needed to leave, and I want to say that's okay. You've had a bereavement or you're sick, that's okay. It's still your responsibility to be in touch with what you missed. It's the reason why we as professors have to have these attendance policies is because the people who don't have a good reason for missing class, those people. But we need to normalize, this isn't a good day for me to be here. And also in terms of movie content, I try to be sensitive to this too. Sometimes I forget. This is a movie that has X content in it and you may not want to watch it for whatever reason. And if you don't, I'll give you an alternative or something like that. I'm certain that would be true in literature or something. Those are all things I think that could be helpful. I would also like to see professors train beyond just the idea that you're going to have autistic and neurodiverse students in your class, and it's not all through DSR.
Oftentimes, depiction and representation in media is sometimes misinformed. They rely on stereotypes, maybe old stigmas. From your perspective, would you say there's been an improvement in depiction in media, in representation these past few years?
I'd say there's been an improvement, but it's, and I don't mean this jokingly, but it's gone just as the treatment of neurodiversity in general has gone from absolutely heinously terrible to bad. I mean, I think we've gone from absolute bigotry to it's on the radar, so that's good. Part of the issues with representation in the content that you see is, as I said before, you can't tell if someone is autistic by looking at them. So one of the unfortunate ways that characters are coded as autistic is stereotyping, like Dr. Sheldon Cooper on The Big Bang Theory or something like that. I personally know someone, I actually talked to her before I came on here, who's autistic, and she is very big on the stereotype that all autistic people are geniuses. There's the idea that we all have this capability, we're all building a nuclear reactor in our garage or something. Well, that's not actually true. Not all autistic people are really smart. So that's something. There's certainly not enough autistic characters of color. There's not enough autistic women in film. And the autistic white guys that you do see tend to be, again, stereotypical nerds with poor social skills. One thing most autistic people, in my experience, need to do is something called stimming. And that's where you get out a kind of buildup of sensory stuff in your body by, in some way, moving your body. And this is something that non-autistic people do as well. Like if you've ever tapped your foot to music or something, that's a stim. But autistic people typically need to do this a lot more than non-autistic people. One of the more obvious ways of doing this is rocking back and forth, and that's not socially acceptable. So a lot of autistic people are taught and are punished, sometimes in school, sometimes by their parents, for doing this. So I would like to see a movie with a character, to see them stimming, to normalize stimming. Normalizing that not all autistic people are white guys would be good. Another thing would be not all autistic people are children. If you Google this, most of the resources you get on autism is in regards to children, usually written from the point of view of a non-autistic or supposedly non-autistic parent trying to diagnose their child. And I find this interesting because it's highly genetic. So there's a decent chance that one of the parents, at least, is autistic themselves. So I'd like to see more autistic adults. I want to see an autistic superhero. I want to see an autistic rom-com. We just want to see it normalized.
So from your perspective, do you think we are starting to see a change happen in society, both with culture, media, and society in general? Do you think we're starting to see people are becoming more aware of it?
Yes, but not enough. If you'd asked me this 10 years ago, I probably would have said yes, and that was a very exciting time. There were a lot of breakthroughs, and the media did start to cover this in different ways, and it was quite a bit better. And that's still happening, but it's at a snail's pace. The progress that seemed to happen around the teens hasn't really paid off in the way I would have liked to have seen it. In many ways, we've gone from close to zero representation to very stereotyped or problematic representation. And there is one thing I would often call this out, the news media, which is a school or a university or something like that has opened up a new program to help autistic students. Most of the time, I would say that's great. I'm not going to criticize that, but it's the way that it's covered is very much, oh, here's cute Jimmy, and isn't it too bad that he's autistic, but look, the school is taking pity on him, and he can bring a Rubik's Cube to school or something. The tone and tenor of these often offensive and belittling to many autistic people. One thing I would actually praise the media on that I post on my Facebook page, which is disturbing, but I feel the need to do it, is the media is very good at covering abuse of autistic children. And if you Google this, you can see a lot of news stories in various places around the United States and probably around the world where, say, autistic students are arrested at school or carried physically into the principal's office or just really terrible stuff. It pains me to see it, but I do applaud news outlets for promoting these things because people need to see this happens and how bad this actually is. And I think most autistic people have some story about something like that happening to them. So I do applaud the news media for covering those kinds of stories and letting people see how bad it really is.
I'm very curious on that perspective because do you think we're especially seeing that with younger generations, like with the current crop of film students coming in with these perspectives? And oftentimes the drive, they want to say, this is me, this is who I am. What do you think is going to become of this?
I think it's getting better, and I don't know if any of my students have heard me say this, but I said this to the faculty. I wish I was 20 years younger, and it's not just because I'm turning 40 and time for my midlife crisis. I wish I was 20 years younger because as I see Gen Z as being more empathetic, less arrogant, and generally more open to neurodiversity, but also really all kinds of diversity than probably any other generation in history, or at least modern history. Not that there aren't serious problems within that generation. But I think that it's probably the best time, in a long time anyway, to be an autistic person. And I think that the openness to this is a lot different. And I think that the main thing that this generation has that mine, at least in the 90s and the early aughts, didn't, is just a kind of openness to being different. I remember just how conformist things were, and I sometimes call it the W word, weird, because autistic people are used to being called that in a very negative way. and are kind of primed or almost triggered to hear that. And this generation, I think, on the whole, doesn't necessarily go, this person is not acting in the way I might necessarily expect, or this person is doing something I don't understand, but let me kind of work with them or at least treat them respectfully and be nice to them.
What advice would you give to your undergrad self? If you could go back in time, speak to your younger self, what would you say to him?
Well, I'd certainly say you're autistic, because I didn't really realize until I was 29. So my life probably would have been a lot different if I had been diagnosed or I realized when I was younger. But I would say, it's a cliche, I would say it gets better. I would also say, just generally, and I think that most people my age would probably say this to younger people, is it's going to be okay. I know that particularly your generation was hit hard by the pandemic and yeah. You missed ending high school and a lot of those kinds of experiences there. But I would also say that you get through things. You get through a lot of difficult things that you didn't think that you actually would. So I would say don't give up, because there are a lot of resources. I think the number one thing, among other things, I wish that I had known when I was younger is, if you have some problem, not even neurodiversity, just, there are often people in the world who are there to help you with that problem, and often that's their job, but you didn't know that and you didn't know how to get that help. And one thing I really applaud the university for is, I'll just give a plug for this, I do this in my classes. If you go to gvsu.edu/support, there's all of these resources for students with tons of different problems, food insecurity or mental health issues or whatever. And there's someone at the university that you can talk to and may be able to point you in the right direction with it. Not necessarily that they can solve every problem, but there's a lot of resources that are available. And I would also say, if you need help, ask for help. This generation is much more comfortable with counseling. If you're uncomfortable with that or you're somewhat reticent about that, I would certainly encourage you to look into that. And there are lots of resources for you, and there are lots of various other things. So, you know, talk to someone that you trust. Don't suffer in silence. I guess that's the main thing. If you have some problem or some issue, there's someone somewhere who wants to help you.
What advice would you have for film students in particular, specifically people pursuing this art form, this industry?
Well, I would say one thing that I find frustrating about any industry is that there's no A to B to C way to success. And film students tend to be very ambitious. The ones who aren't very ambitious usually drop out pretty fast and they do something else, because you got to be willing to work hard and work weekend, 12-hour days, all that stuff. And one of the most common questions that we get asked is, how can I be a movie director, or how can I be a successful editor or something like that? And unfortunately, there's no real steps that you can do to guarantee success. I mean, there are people who've gotten every break that you can think of and they hadn't made it. And there are also people who have been just completely struck by lightning and had amazing careers. I want to say it's very hard, particularly if you're ambitious, to kind of deprogram yourself of that. You have to be like the feather in Forrest Gump. You're very, very based on luck and the current situation. I remember telling someone, suppose that I somehow got $1 million or $2 million to make a feature film together, and it was March of 2020. What would have happened there? I worked for 5 years to get this money together, and then the pandemic happens, and those things just kind of happen. It's kind of a bitter pill to swallow when you're young, and now I am sounding old, because you want to control so much, and the world, at least for me, and I think for most people, even very successful people, the Coppola or Scorsese or Tarantino or Spike Lee or someone like that, they would probably say, I believe I'm talented, I worked really hard, and I was in the right place at the right time. Another piece of advice that I would give, and this is the film professor, film history and theory person, is you gotta watch and understand the classics. Often the freshman students coming in are apprehensive about watching movies in black and white or silent films, and they say something like, I don't like to watch an older film. And I'll say, like, what is an older film? And they say, well, a movie made in the 90s or something. And for me, an old movie is like a movie made in the 1890s. If I was teaching, which I used to teach, read Toni Morrison and Charles Dickens and J.D. Salinger, read the great works of literature. in the same way, if you're a filmmaker, you have an enormous advantage over a writer because it'll take you 2 to 4 hours to watch one of the great works, whereas they might have to read a 500-page poem in Middle English or something. So you owe it to yourself to watch every film on the site and sound list. Find some critic that you like and watch every film on their 100 to 25 best list. One thing that I find very edifying is watching everything that they've did, not just their famous films or the films that you like, because you learn from what's considered to be their lesser films, their failures, and it helps you understand how an artist works. For the most part, careers are combinations of bad, good, mediocre, and amazing. Watch movies that get you out of your aesthetic comfort zone. So those two things. Could I tell the story about how I was diagnosed?
Absolutely.
Okay. This is actually an entertaining, at least to me, story about how I found out. I was living in England doing my PhD, and I met a woman online who's a very dear friend of mine, Shell. And we went out, didn't really seem to work out that well, but we stayed in contact and we were friends. So 2 years later, she posts on her Facebook page that she had been diagnosed as autistic. So I Googled it and I kind of knew in about 5 seconds that it was me. Of course, I was going, no, wait, you're being paranoid and this isn't you and there's all that. I tried to put it on the back burner while I was in Italy with the novelty of the vacation. But during some lulls, I went online. I was like, okay, I really should look into this and I should go to the doctor. It took me 4 years from the time I suspected to the time I was diagnosed. I was actually diagnosed officially the week before I left England. So I suspected 3 years because it was right before my 30th birthday, and I was diagnosed when I was 33. It took that long, and that is also not an unusual experience for particularly autistic adults. It takes a long time. And over there, I had the access to the wonderful NHS. Even with that, it took forever. Whereas over here, the United States does not have as good of a healthcare system. And there are a lot of horror stories, particularly from adults, about the difficulties of getting a diagnosis. I contacted Shell and I was like, that was really brave that you did that, which is true. I mean, it certainly changed my life. I asked her, do you think I'm autistic? And she said, yeah, I think that you are. And I started asking my friends and I thought they would say, no, come on. But most of them, the reaction was, yeah. I wanted to share that. One, because I'm doing this really for the same reasons that Shell posted on her Facebook page, is that the more people that are public about this, the less shame and stigma, and it encourages other people who might be suspecting themselves to go down that road. And particularly because Shell and I both think it's about 50-50, the ratio from men to women, and of course some people are non-binary. About 20 years ago, it was 10% of people diagnosed were women. And now it's gone up to about a third, and we both think that it's near parity because women, for various reasons, are usually taught to cover it up more. I would also say one thing that gave me a little pause doing this is every time I disclose this to someone, there is a lot of, how is this person going to react? And should I tell my employer? Tell a family member? How does this actually work? And every time that you do that, you don't quite know what their reaction is. So that's part of the motivation for doing this as well.
Awesome. So one thing you were discussing earlier, kind of the differences between introverted people versus extroverted, and how oftentimes tends to be a stigma associated with autistic people tending to be quiet. But as you mentioned, that's not always the case. So would you like to elaborate that?
Yeah. One of the reasons I'm also doing this is I can't really speak for other autistic people. I can only really speak for myself. But I also feel an obligation to speak because I am an extrovert and I do public speaking for a living as a professor. And I know a lot of autistic people, which is to a degree somewhat of a stereotype, but it is certainly true, who are shy and just don't like to be part of the public eye. And I want to say that it's completely okay to be like that. And there are some non-autistic people, who keep to themselves, and that's just the way that they are. And that's beautiful, and that's great. I also feel another thing that many autistic people often say is you can't win. It's sort of like you sit there and you be quiet and you don't ask questions and you don't say anything and people complain that you're antisocial and that you're not participating, but then you ask questions, you make suggestions and comments and people say that you're doing it in the wrong way or you're too loud or you're not doing it enough. or you're doing it too much, I should say. So the thing is that if you are particularly in that latter group, you might miss social cues or interrupt someone. That doesn't necessarily mean that this person is being rude. It just means this person might be missing some of these social cues. But I think what many holistic people perceive that as is this person is just being a jerk and they're given negative social pressure because of that. And then the person who has no idea what social rule they missed just feels like people are attacking them personally and is less likely to participate, and then they are accused of being too quiet. So that's also why I think greater attention needs to be given to issues of affect. And to a degree, the way we think about social skills is actually quite ableist. And we need to have a way of not judging people solely based on their ability to follow social etiquette. Those kinds of situations are something that autistic people often struggle with. And also, you develop a sense of paranoia because you're never certain, like you meet somebody, we should have lunch, or I'm interested in this business idea you have or something. You're never really certain, do they really mean that? Or are they just saying that to be polite or to get rid of you or something like that? And you carry that around with you because you're never totally certain what does this person actually mean when they say that.
You mentioned you've got some projects in the work. What are you working on? What's going on with you?
I have a lot of projects that I'm working on. I try to write one script a year. The thing I most want to do is a script I have about an autistic woman in the 1890s. I wrote it right after I was diagnosed myself, and I would say that probably out of all the scripts that I've written or all the projects I'd want to work on, that's the one that I would most want to make. And I started thinking about what it would be like to be autistic in a different time period. And that's another thing that I would say. You don't usually see, we think of autism as being very contemporary, but it's actually been around probably since caveman time. So that's the favorite out of all the scripts that I've written. I wrote the story treatment with a friend of mine, and I wrote the script myself. I just started writing a historical film about King Alfred of England, who's the first king of England. That is just a fun script. So what's fun about this King Alfred script is I'm giving myself an unlimited budget. I'm not doing that thing of like, how can I actually film this? I'm just writing this David Lean epic. And if it ever does get made, I'll probably be able to make 2 minutes of it on whatever budget I get. I'm very interested in historical film. I actually think that historical films and historical theater are the closest that we ever get to time travel. When I was in England, there was a revival of Terence Rattigan, the British playwright, who had been forgotten for a while, but a lot of his plays were produced while I was over there. It just felt like you had gone back in time to the 1940s or 50s. I really love the film medium's ability to show you past times and how they looked. I'm fascinated by that. I wanted to be a movie director, so being a film professor was not my first career, but at this point, I've set the goals. I don't want to die before at least making one feature film, hopefully several. The script about the autistic woman is the one that would like to make the most, and I think I could do that on a relatively low budget, but that's what I'm working on. I'm also working on my second book. I actually have two ideas for a second book. So I have one book out, which is an adaptation of my thesis, my PhD thesis about World War I. This one would be a sequel to that, which would be about films about World War I made in the 50s and 60s, and I'm particularly interested in comparisons between World War I and what we refer to as the Vietnam War, which I don't think that's the best historical way of calling that, but just that's what probably most listeners would be familiar with. And also, I have another idea for a book that I actually wrote the proposal for this, but I haven't submitted it because right now, if I did get the contract for it, I wouldn't have the time to write it, called Before Rain Man. And the idea for this is that it's about films about autism that don't know it. That's about autistic characters in cinema before we had the codified idea of what autism was. The most obvious one to me would be Sherlock Holmes, and I'm a Sherlock Holmes fan. That's a book that has been on the back burner for a while, but if I do get some time off, I'd like to write that.
Well, that's about all the time we have. Ryan, thank you so much for sitting with us today to discuss this. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences and insight. It was a wonderful pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Alumni Live, the podcast. Subscribe to our podcast to hear more from our alumni across the industry. Check out Alumni Live on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube for more conversations and networking. Let us know what topics you want to hear our alumni talk about. The Grand Valley State University Film Video Alumni Network is here for you, and we're glad that you're here. Thank you for listening.